You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the military focus on Iraq shifts to finding weapons of mass destruction, the transitional government, headed by State Department careerist L. Paul Bremer, will seek to institute a democratic form of government in war-torn Iraq. But many groups question what role Iraqis will have in the decision-making process. Today, as anti-American riots erupt in cities throughout the world, there are concerns that the military action used to, quote, free Iraq, unquote, has unsettling consequences for civil liberties in Iraq and right here in the U.S. Peace Watch recently spoke with Barbara Olshansky, the assistant legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, about her thoughts on the so-called war on terror.
It's not at all clear after years of admitted repression what the people of Iraq actually want. And one of the things that is of concern is who the United States is selecting as people that are going to be in the political mix. And it's not clear that these are people that the Iraqi citizenry has faith in and trust. In part, that's a function of individuals that have been outside the country for a number of years. And it's also a function of the fact that people that were long-term members of the Ba'ath Party are being put into the mix by the United States government. And so there is, you know, I think legitimate reason for concern on behalf of the Iraqi people. You know, what happens in the event that what the Iraqi people choose is not something that the United States government is comfortable with? Surrounding all of these issues about their right to choose and their right of self-determination, what is the United States commitment going to be to those international principles and rules of law which it has cast aside in undertaking this action in the first instance?
For example?
We are talking about those principles in the Geneva Conventions and in other treaties that talk about the right to self-determination, the right to self-rule. And although we have not heard, like, the concrete plans for the creation of the political structure, what we are hearing is that there are very specific ideas that the United States government has about what that should look like and who should be involved. We would like to see, and I think what the rest of the world would like to see, is the opportunity for the people there to determine their own fate.
So when we hear Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld saying that there won't be any clerics running
right,
the country.
Right, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. And our model of democracy here is not the only model. You know, democracy manifests itself in many ways around the world. And parliamentary democracies that exist, I mean, they're very often coalition governments where a number of parties share power. And is that what, you know, the people of Iraq would choose, to have maybe a religious party be part of a coalition government? And who would be involved? You know, that might not be to the liking of the, you know, Department of Defense. But it might very well be what democracy would evolve to and look like in Iraq.
We saw reports where several people caught stealing were paraded naked in the streets with words tattooed on their chest.
Right. And I think the United States, by picking and choosing when it's going to invoke the Geneva Conventions, and other conventions and treaties that we've signed and ratified, we've created a precedent for the rest of the world to violate those treaties and conventions.
Mm-hmm. To pick and choose which ones we want.
Right,
to.
And to engage in unprovoked aggression. And, you know, the next country that does this might not be a democracy. Mm-hmm. It might be a country that we're very worried about somewhere else, and they do it. And then what authority, what credibility do we have to invoke the international institutions to stop them?
There's really no way that we can require that the U.S. adhere to those conventions, for example, the Convention Against Torture.
In addition to a very tough legal battle, it is an incredibly tough political battle, because judges are reluctant to step out and say to the executive branch of the government, what you are doing is outrageous. And, you know, the thing for us is, fortunately, oddly enough, the executive branch has been so outrageous in its demands on the other branches of government that we are getting courts to say that, to say the separation of powers between these three co-equal branches means something, and you can't, Rumsfeld, tell me that I can't review what you do. And this is a long battle that we have now, because we do have an executive branch that's sort of you know, gone off the deep end and has tried to tell the rest of the government, you don't get to say what happened.
And it sort of leads us right to the climate here, the battle here, many would say, for reclaiming our own civil liberties in the context of this so-called war on terrorism, where many Americans don't seem to feel as though our own civil liberties are being encroached upon. What are your thoughts about that? Is this a really dangerous climate for us that we're living in?
I have a good friend who works for the United Nations in Europe, and I was talking with her yesterday and just about this climate and really how distressing it is to us. It started out immediately after September 11th, and because so many things are happening so quickly in terms of the erosion of civil rights and civil liberties, it's hard to keep up. You know, what we have seen is in sort of every realm that you can possibly imagine in your life, there has been this incredible encroachment. And it's taken various forms. You know, immediately after 9/11, we had all of those individuals, you know, rounded up thousands. And we only know about 2,000 of them in the first 7 weeks. And then the government decided that it was not going to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. So we stopped learning anything about any actions that were taken by the federal government. And so that was sort of step one. You don't get to know, even though there's this federal law in the books, we're not going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we heard is, of these people rounded up, none of them had any criminal allegations. There were no terrorism allegations. They had overstayed tourist visas, which is a civil violation. It's just like a ticket, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we had put them in jail. And that's really not the worst of it, although it's bad enough. What we then did is, even when the judge said to them in the immigration court, do you want to go home, Mr. Turkman, for example,
mm-hmm.
And he says, yes, and I have my plane ticket. And the judge says, I'll give you an order of voluntary departure. You didn't do anything wrong. You can come back any time. You just overstayed a tourist visa. That's not great, but it's okay. Just go home. Well, then the federal government, the FBI and the INS, kept people like Mr. Turkman up to 18 months until they were cleared. We turned this notion, innocent until proven guilty, on its head. But there wasn't even a charge out there for people like Mr. Turkman and the thousands of others. They were just kept. And so that already is this incredible invasion of people's rights.
Mm-hmm.
They're not criminals. We're not holding them pursuant to the immigration law. How are we keeping them in detention? And, you know, with the enactment of the Patriot Act, that line of, well, we were first going after immigrants because we think people here on visas did the acts of 9/11, we then moved it and blurred that line to take into consideration citizens. And so now, if you're a non-citizen, you're subject to military tribunals and indefinite detention, like what happened to Mr. Turkman. And the military tribunals can be secret, with really out of right to a lawyer that doesn't have, like, security clearance, and even then he can't go through everything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know the offenses you're going to be tried under. You don't know where it's going to take place. There's no appeal. You could be sentenced to execution, and no one will ever know.
In this country.
In this country. That's for non-citizens. And then people would say to me, okay, well, I'm a citizen. Well, first of all, it depends on how you define those terms. Do you mean if you have a green card, it's not at all clear that you don't go to a military tribunal? But let's say you were born here, like me. What happens to people like me? Well, we have Jose Padilla. He was arrested here at O'Hare Airport. They first thought he was a material witness. Then they made allegations that are really not clear. And I'm working on that case, and so I know what's in the record.
Mm-hmm.
No one says he's a member of Al-Qaeda. No one's charged him with a crime. And he's an American citizen. He's being held now in executive indefinite detention for the duration of the war on terrorism. And the government is arguing he doesn't have the right to have an attorney, to be brought to court, to talk to his family, to see anybody else.
When is the war on terrorism going to be over?
Well, that, you know, that's one of the things that the court said. Well, we have to, you know, bow to the executive. And so look at our choices. If you're a citizen, you can be denoted an enemy combatant. If you're a non-citizen, you can be executed in a military tribunal. And when I say this all in one breath, I am astounded. This doesn't look like the country that I grew up in.
It exceeds what we refer to as the McCarthy era. Are we going to be reading about this time in our history in the future as the Ashcroft era?
You know, I was talking to a professor of history the other day who wrote several books on the McCarthy era, and she said what you'll find in there are things that pale in comparison to what's happening now. And, you know, we get calls every day from peace groups, from women's rights groups that are now, someone's calling the city police department, the FBI, and saying that they think that they're a terrorism group. And all of a sudden we have intelligence officers calling people who are members of peace groups, of Pax Christi, the Catholic peace group, or other peace groups, in for questioning. And I think, are we for standing on the corner and saying what you believe, for holding up a sign, for issuing a statement, now you're likely a terrorist and you're going to be subject to this interrogation? This is, you know, just unprecedented. McCarthy era. We haven't seen anything like this.
And how do freedom-loving, justice-loving civil libertarians in this country go about reclaiming the Constitution?
Well, this is a good optimistic part of our discussion, because I do think that that is happening, and I really do believe that people are really trying. I think the peace movement laid the groundwork for, you know, people to, you know, be engaged in the discussion that, you know, we haven't been a part of. And there's a number of things happening. You know, we see, you know, the National Librarians Association telling, you know, our Attorney General, we're not going to give you lists of the books people read, and deciding to shred the, you know, the book circulation lists and doing those kinds of things. And people are requesting that their public libraries do that. And around the country, they're doing that. And there's also the these Bill of Rights defense committees that are starting in cities all around the country. We're working on that. Other groups are working on that to pass resolutions, which don't necessarily have the effect of a law, but say that, you know, the cities, the towns, the counties are not going to take actions that violate the Constitution or the constitutional rights of people, you know, discriminating them on the basis of race or religion or ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those actions are happening. And they're happening from, you know, from the block level up, which is, to me, heartening. You know, that's the way it's supposed to go. Ashcroft and Bush never consulted the people. And the people are going to have their say. I'm convinced of it.
That was Barbara Olshansky, the assistant legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Her most recent book is entitled Against War with Iraq, an Anti-War Primer. In paying his tribute to the troops tonight, President Bush is expected to portray the Iraq War as just one piece of the continuing war on terror. He also is expected to broadly outline, according to a senior administration official, his vision of a new kind of warfare. In 1987, three peace activists sat on the rails of the Concord Naval Weapons Depot to protest the huge amounts of ammunition shipped to Central America and used against the people of Nicaragua in the bloody Civil War. Instead of stopping, the approaching train picked up speed and crushed Vietnam War veteran Brian Wilson. He survived, but lost both of his legs. Several months ago on the program Hearts and Minds on Pacifica affiliate station KMUD in Northern California, he spoke about his experience in Vietnam and how it led him to become a different kind of soldier, a soldier for peace.
There was a rumor that the South Vietnamese pilots were deliberately missing their targets. So the job was to go and examine targets shortly after the bombing missions, and my lieutenant sidekick, whose name was Bo, knew approximately the times of the bombing missions. A Vietnamese lieutenant who spoke good English, who had been trained in the United States. So we drove about 45 minutes to a little village near Sadek. Sure enough, we could see the smoke coming from a very recent bombing. And we got to the village within 15 minutes, I guess, after it had been bombed. So this was the first shock to me, was that the target was a village. I guess I hadn't thought much about what a target was. I was still pretty naive. And we got out and started walking into the village, which was not very big. Everything had been destroyed, and the first thing I remember hearing was the loud roars of a water buffalo who was lying on the ground off to our right. And then I turned my head to the left and looked down, and all I saw were dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of bodies. And I guess I was beginning to go into shock, some kind of traumatic shock. And I noticed that virtually everybody that I could recognize in terms of a body looked like a young female and or young children, and I remember seeing a couple of very elderly people. They were all either motionless on the ground or they were a few moving very slowly. And I was very obviously upset and troubled and kind of thought that maybe this bombing had been the result of a misplaced or misguided intelligence. As the lieutenant to my right could see that I was very upset, in fact, I was gagging. I was heaving with sobs, I think. Once I was able to access this scene, which took me 12 years before I had a flashback, I noticed he was grinning, and he said, "What's wrong?" And I looked at a young woman holding three children almost immediately at my feet. I said something to the effect that this was my family. And I don't know kind of where that came from. And he laughed again and said they were communists. And he said, "You know, when I know that our pilots are bombing this precisely, I feel like we can win this war." And at that point, I knew that I was no longer the naive little country boy from upstate New York. And the scuttlebutt back in the command bunker was always, these Vietnamese are stupid because they had been given warning with leaflets in Vietnamese to leave their villages because they were now designated in a free fire zone. And they were instructed as to where to move themselves and what they could carry on their back. And it took me a little while to grasp really what was going on anthropologically, historically, and so forth. And if they had to be removed from their ancestral spirits and bodies and couldn't take their farm animals and were physically separated from the land that they had farmed for generations, they would rather die. After that first experience, we had a library. I said, "Is there any books on the history of French and U.S. intervention in Vietnam?" There was about seven books on the shelf, but one was by two Cornell University professors called The United States and Vietnam by Cahin and Lewis. And I read that book. I was shocked that I had not known anything about the history of the Vietnamese struggle for independence from the Chinese, from the French, from the Japanese, and then from the French again, and now the United States. To realize that I and thousands of other young North Americans and millions of Vietnamese were being killed, maimed, and terrorized by a series of lies. It just struck me so profoundly while I was there. On one occasion, I went up to Saigon, and we had an intelligence office in Saigon. And I happened to be flipping through the paperwork there. I happened to see a report of a bombing in early April, which I recognized by the date and the time as the village that I had witnessed and that the report of which was my report. And the report from 7th Air Force said that 130 VC were killed. When I wrote my report, I said approximately 65 civilians, mostly female and children, had been killed and probably an equal number severely injured. So there was another example where I was registering that there was a manufacture of a fact based on a preconceived notion of what they needed back in Washington, but it was not what really happened. I started talking to my superiors about the war every day. I said, this is an illegal war. We are killing civilians deliberately. This is in violation of the United Nations Charter. This is in violation of our own military regulations. This is in violation of the Nuremberg Principles. And they thought I was a lunatic. My whole pursuit for the last 30 years has been searching for soul. It's a pretty amazing feat that nation state governments can order thousands of their young citizens, train them to kill, and send them thousands of miles away from their homeland to participate in killing other people who we know nothing about. We, as a people, in this nation and in the Western world in general, cannot continue to live as we are. There's not the resources to enable us to do this. Even if we were a bully and could get away with it militarily, it's a delusion that we can live the way we're living. And I'm hoping that Bush is like a cosmic gift that makes it real obvious. It seems to me now we need not just an anti-war movement, we need a justice movement like never before, something beyond where the civil rights movement was. We need this coalescence of environmental groups, peace groups, anti-globalization groups, and justice people to come together and realize that without working for justice, we cannot solve this addiction we have to war.
Vietnam War veteran Brian Wilson speaking on Pacifica affiliate station KMUD's Hearts and Minds. Finally tonight, longtime poet and pacifist Sam Hamill declined an invitation in January to attend a symposium by First Lady Laura Bush to celebrate poetry and the American voice. He said he could not, in good faith, visit the White House in light of the Bush administration's plans to launch a unilateral attack on Iraq. Hamill asked about 50 fellow poets to submit poems of protest to send to the White House. When 1,500 poets responded within 4 days, Laura Bush went on to cancel the event. Hamill went on to create a website, poetsagainstthewar.org. On this May Day, Poets Against the War has taken the opportunity to hold international poetry readings for peace and against the U.S. war and occupation of Iraq. Gary Bullhauer, a 52-year-old father of three from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, shares his poem entitled, I Dare to Wish You Peace.
I dare to wish you peace today, not in some future dreamed utopia, but today, with this heartbeat, now, with this breath. I wish you peace with enemies, with rebels, with terrorists. Peace with those who call their God by another name, who pledge their allegiance to a different flag, who think the promised land is their land. I wish you peace today with those who feel the embrace of the universe in a newborn hand grasping their fingers, with those who drink to love and promises at the marriage of their children, with those who know the darkness of the grave's goodbye. Stand by the mother, first time nursing this child just slipped into light. Stand by the bedside of the grandmother, almost gone, the smell of peppers in her hair. Stand with your arms around the bride and groom, smiling. Can you stand there and tell me we are not one family? That peace is not possible? I dare to wish you peace now. In this heartbeat in this common breath.
Wisconsin poet Gary Bullhauer. Susan Doherty, a mother and a clinical psychologist from Brooklyn, New York, shares her poem entitled, Let Us Try What Love Can Do.
These sanctions are killing us both, my friend. The telephone, an explosive device, your anthrax-laced remarks, my radioactive glances. Is this who we truly are? All bombs are suicide bombs. The poison I drop into your well seeps into my own groundwater. The wind boomerangs your herbicide and devastates your crops. I no longer care who's in the right. I don't care what you have done. I don't care what I have done or what they say we did. We're siblings in this fragile house. I will no longer cut my flesh to spill my blood. Look out the window. There go my sword and shield floating down the East River. I raise the trumpet of my love and over the tumbled barricade reach out my naked hand.
New York poet Susan Doherty. And finally, our own associate producer, Angelique Chauffard, who is also a yoga teacher and holistic healer from Monrovia, Liberia, shares her recently written piece entitled War Lingers On Forever.
The experience of war lingers on forever. The rush of war runs through my vein, like creepy spiders lost in a drain. Old forgotten images still haunt my daydreams. I see truckloads of bodies as I stare out my window. Arms and legs sticking out, dark skins parched by the sun. Frightened by the sights I see, too young to even understand. I sit on my heels and cover my face because I want what I see to go away. Bang, bang, bang on our door. Our home has been chosen to find out more. Soldiers come rushing in with guns I've never seen. Get on the floor, they scream. Who lives here? Who lives here, they demand. Wanting to find a wealthy man to strip him of what they feel they never had. Stay in your homes and don't come outside, for if you do, you may not live through this fright. Rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat. Gunshot going off all through the night. My friend has been raped by the instruments that kill. They force a gun up her womb, raping her over and over. Can you feel this sight? The torture, the terror? War holds a secret room in my house, in the house of my soul. I kept this room locked until the invasion of Iraq. But now as I write this poem, the door is opening up. I only wish that the light of love and peace would cleanse this room in my house.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. We had production assistance from Jem Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Benta Berkland, Reem Kathuda, and Adam Campy. Thanks to Pete Karak at RadioForAll.net and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for their generous financial support over the past several weeks in response to our urgent appeal. Thanks to your support, Peace Watch will continue to be broadcast. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.